Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Robin MacArthur, author of Heart Spring Mountain, published in January by Echo. Robin lives in Marlborough, Vermont, not far from where she was born, and not far from where the novel takes place. Her debut collection of short stories, Half Wild, won the 2017 Penn New England Award for Fiction. She's also one half of the musical duo Red Heart the Ticker, alongside her husband, Tyler Gibbons. And I suggest you check out their music on YouTube or at their website, RHTT. Heart Spring Mountain is a novel about death, disaster, love, loss, and heartbreak. These things, things we have all experienced, are told through the lens of three generations of women. The absent protagonist, Bonnie, who disappears during 2011's Tropical Storm Irene, and Vale, who leaves her bartending and exotic dancing job in New Orleans and comes back to her little town in Vermont to try and find her mom. During this quest, Vale reunites with the matriarch of this family, Hazel, and her widowed cousin-in-law, Deb. Vale, when she's not searching for her mother, is intrigued by the family's history and tries to preserve it as she uncovers secrets about it. Some of the other characters are painted just as distinctly as our main protagonists, Bonnie's mom, Deb's husband, and the absent Bonnie herself. The novel is evocative as it brings up memories and experiences we all share in an almost poetic fashion, and at the same time tells us that there is always room for hope and change. So with that, welcome, Robin, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for that nice synopsis of the book, and I'm delighted to be on your podcast.
Thanks. Before I go off on my many times irrelevant tangents, tell us a little bit about your book more than I did in the introduction, because we're here to sell your book, hopefully in my bookshop, where you figure prominently right now on our front table. So why don't you tell us a little bit in your own words about the book?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for showing it in your bookstore.
You're welcome.
So this book began almost 9 years ago for me. I was a young mother. I was trying to figure out, I had returned home to Vermont, up to the land where I grew up. I was trying to figure out the ways in which the landscape holds secrets and the ways in which the landscape reveals our past to us and we can know ourselves through a landscape. I was also trying to figure out family relationships. As a new mother, I knew that I had been handed down both gifts and struggles, and I saw those very clearly as soon as I became a mother. And so I became fascinated by the ways in which the landscape holds stories and our bodies hold the stories of the generations before us. And so in many ways, Vale, although her biography is very different from my own, she was significantly younger than I was at that time, and she was not a mother, and I was not an exotic dancer in New Orleans. She is still on the same quest, which is to find herself by returning to this landscape where she had grown up and where her family has lived for generations, and unpack both the history of the landscape and her family history through returning. And the story also became very much about climate change and the kind of instability of our political world right now. As I was writing it, Tropical Storm Irene moved through Vermont, which was a hurricane as it came north and then turned into a tropical storm when it hit Vermont and caused huge amounts of flooding and immense damage throughout the state. And although it was nowhere near as damaging as the many storms that occur almost daily around the world, it was a real wake-up call to me as a mother of young children about the effects of climate change and how they will be everywhere. And there's no escaping these storms and this changing, shifting world that we live in. And so the story became climate change wove its way into just the fabric of these characters' lives. They, like me, are questioning what the past can teach us about what we've lost and where we are, why we are where we are now, and what the past can teach us about resiliency and hope and connection and surviving hard times.
Okay. Here's where I start going off on my tangents. Music is everywhere in your book. How does that bring us closer to the family, or you closer to the family, both your personal family and the family in the book and the story they tell?
I'm sorry, was there a question in there? Can you repeat it?
Yeah, it's like every chapter there's music and there's all kinds of artists, and there's all kinds of artists I identify with. And how does that music, and I hate this word, inform the novel and obviously takes up a big part of your life as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I loved about moving from the short story form to the novel was that the novel, it just seems like this incredible net that can contain whatever the writer, you know, as long as you pull it off, whatever the writer is obsessing about on the day that you are sitting down to write. And so music is a huge part of my life. My grandmother, when she moved to Vermont in the late 1940s, set out to, she had come from the South where there were very rich musical traditions, and she wanted to know what the musical traditions of Vermont were, so she set out in this Jeep Willy. She eventually had five kids and took them driving around back roads in search of songs that were embedded here in southern Vermont and recorded them on this Wallensack reel-to-reel tape recorder. And then she spent the rest of her life, she lived up the road from me in a farmhouse, and she spent the rest of her life recording old songs and performing old songs. And so for me, music was really my first poetry. I would sleep on the edge of stages with her as she was performing, and she would often have musical guests at her farmhouse. And so ballads about place and old British Isle murder ballads, those are my introduction to poetry and to literature and what it was. This oral tradition is how I entered became a writer.
You know, it's even like,
what's that?
Oh, Scott, it's even like when you mentioned John Prine, who I first saw in Ithaca, New York in 1970, and then that sentence when Stephen, ghost-like, appears to Deb and says, "Hello in there, hello."
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know.
That's a little John Prine reference for those other John Prine fans out there.
And there's things like that throughout the book. And, I thought of the song Bottomless Lake, too, but the problem with that is Bottomless Lake is really funny. But just the concept of the Bottomless Lake evokes the fact that, you know, water also, like music, water is everywhere in your book. And and the cold is everywhere in your book. And, you know, sometimes reading it, I felt cold, and I was wondering how these characters could go out in the cold and into the water. And, you know, it gave you like kind of literal and figurative shivers.
I love music. Music is a huge part of my life, and there's a part of me, I did make a playlist as I was writing the book.
I bet, yeah.
So I had, you know, my John Prine tunes and my Nina Simone tunes, and whenever I wanted to kind of tap into the emotion that I wanted a scene to have, I would play those songs. And, you know, in some ways maybe it's cheating to insert music, because it does, if the reader knows that song, it can make the scene much more three-dimensional. It can have an auditory component, which is a thrill, you know. It becomes almost like a little movie in the mind that contains music if the reader knows the song.
Your goal is still to make the... Your goal is always to make the book three-dimensional, and I think that's what you've done, whether it's through music or some other device. So the idea is that, you know, the reader becomes more, you know, the reader learns from the book, and not only learns from the book, but somehow it's almost like therapy, and that's what this book does. You know, it kind of like, they call it like bibliotherapy, and it's kind of like that. But, you know, but then I thought, like when you talk about the finality, well, when Vale's boyfriend talks about the finality of every single death is unbearable. When you're talking about El Salvador or mothers in Iraq or mothers in Syria and Somalia and mothers in countries we can read about in the paper today. And you talk about it in almost, I think, in a Pollyannish way, because how do we really deal with that? I mean, how can we empathize with these people without kind of destroying our own minds, our lives? I mean, because there's so much going on, and he's suggesting that he can go back and take photographs, bring them back, and it's going to change something. And I'm kind of like pragmatically fatalistic, so I'm thinking, how will that change that? And you seem much more optimistic than me.
Well, I think, you know, these are very dark times that we are living in. I was reading Rebecca Solnit's Hope in the Dark during much of the writing of this book, and she talks about just that change is, we don't know how change occurs, and hope is being comfortable with ambiguity and unknowns. And so I like to think of that. The photographer who's taking photographs in Iraq, he doesn't know what the effect of his work will be, nor does Vale know what the effect of her life will be. You know, none of us know whether our altruism or our art or our whatever it is, the books that we write, will have a lasting impact on the world, but nor do we know that they will not have a lasting impact on the world. So I really think there is a lot of discussion of art and being an artist and what is the purpose of that. In part, we do it just because it's what we are called to do, and we hope that we are one facet of a much bigger picture that will lead toward good change alongside, you know, the inevitable darkness and suffering that will also come. But it is ultimately a story of hope, and I was thinking very much about art and the unknown roads that it follows.
Yeah, and one of those parallel roads in the book is like that part when Deb senses kind of the presence of her family and the fact that they were Native American. She says it makes sense epigenetically, and, you know, the idea of being called back to the land, being drawn back to the woods, the creeks, the swamps, kind of like what we were talking about earlier. I thought that was fascinating, too, because I don't know whether I feel that a lot. I mean, there's places I go to that I know I feel like I'm at home. But it seems to me that you really feel that, because it's almost as if your life is overlaid to a certain extent on top of the book.
Yeah, in some ways it's very easy for me. You know, home is not a question. I don't have to ask where home is.
Right.
And I know so many people who do struggle with that question. You know, where do they feel most at home? And Vermont is a very interesting state because so many people who come here, travel here, do feel at home when they arrive here. There's something just about the landscape that resonates with a lot of people. My mother was one of those people. She came from the suburbs of Chicago when she was 18. She had met my dad. She moved here. She dropped out of college a week later, and she's never left. She just said,
wow,
this is home. I was meant to be here.
Yep.
And so I am exploring some of that in the book, how much of that sense of home is epigenetic and written in our DNA, and how much of it is the stories that we are told about place and how those all interact.
So going off on another tangent, it so happens that I have peacocks as well at my house. And
oh, wow.
So listen, I have peacocks, I have goats, I have chickens, I have two alpacas, I have cats, and like, what else do I have? And a couple of other things. But anyway, so sometimes in the morning, I'll go up to the top of the driveway, and they're all there, like, talking. And when I get there, they kind of stop. And I think, what are they? I know they're talking about me. And they're plotting something against me. And it's the peacocks who are the leaders, because they hate me, and I kind of hate them, too.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even have to feed them, because they'll eat anything. And they don't mind the cold, because they're from India, northern India. But it's just like I have this, you know, this mystical feeling that they are, in fact, plotting against me. And so far, nothing's happened, but I know.
I love that.
I know they're planning something.
And that makes me want to go out and get some peacocks. I mean, I wrote about it in my novel, but why haven't I done it in my own life?
You can just...
I have chickens, but I need peacocks.
Yeah, you can just order mail order. My post office lady, I live in a rural area too, so my post office lady was really upset because she had to take care, I was out of town, so she had to take care of the little baby peacocks for a couple of days.
Oh my goodness.
And, but yeah, they're fascinating. They do not need me, more so than cats. They definitely do not need me, and they're not very interested in me, and they don't want me bothering. But they're beautiful, and they just wander around.
Do they have any natural predators? Are they at risk of being wiped?
No, I mean, when they need to fly, they fly. And I've seen them fly across a field, and they find places if they see. And, you know, when they fan out, when they do have their plumage, when they fan out, they scare pretty much everything off because they're really big. But be that as it may, also, there's lots of food in your book. How come?
Mm-hmm.
What?
The food. Talk about the food. I lost you for a second.
Yeah, I know. This is what I do.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I love food. I love wine. I love coffee. And that all winds its way through the book. And I just had a review where somebody said, the weather is terrible and the food is even worse. And I just had to laugh out loud because art is so subjective. Everything in life is subjective. And I thought the food in my book was pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, there was some there was some French cheese, and there were lots of stews made from vegetables that Deb had grown and Ginny had grown. And I do. I live on a farm. My mom is a vegetable farmer. I'm kind of a bad farmer, but I have a vegetable garden and try to teach my kids how to grow peas and lettuce and carrots. And I do think so much about how, you know, in my moments of climate anxiety, this is a skill that we need to keep alive. We need to know how to grow food. And even if there is not an apocalyptic food shortage situation, during storms like Irene, my road was literally cut off from a grocery store for a week. And it wasn't a problem on my road because we have vegetables and gardens and farms and lots of dried beans and food in the freezer. So I do think about that resiliency and how there's a lost art of making meals from the land that I wanted to bring into the book.
Well, and the other thing is, and we talked about this earlier too, is do you know how many times the word coffee is mentioned in your book since I... Rid of it on my iPad.
Did you count it?
Yeah, 51.
And, all right.
And one is coffee pot, which I count, and the other is coffee table, which I don't count. So it's really 50. But so coffee, and it's made so many different ways in the book, obviously must be in your life as well, which it is in mine.
Mm-hmm.
So you stuck it in there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wine in the book as well.
Yeah, there is.
Just talking about this with my brother. My brother is a cider maker. He worked on a vineyard in southern France.
Cool.
And then came back here and started realizing that traditional New England beverage is hard cider. So he uses traditional cider apples and makes hard cider. And he's also a coffee-making aficionado. He loves his particular beans and his particular method. So we were laughing, why is my book so full of wine and coffee, and why does he spend his life obsessing over wine and coffee? And I think we've concluded that our parents are farmers and carpenters and truly workaholics, and the only time they ever sat down was if there was a cup of coffee or a glass of beer or wine involved. So I think that for both of us, there's a real ceremony around coffee and a beverage. And it's a moment where it is a little communion of sorts. You know, you stop and you have time to reflect on the meaning of life and notice the world, observe the world around you, and gather with others in a celebratory way. So I think that is the root of my obsession.
Yeah, and it kind of even made me comfortable in the book. And I drank coffee, you know, it made me go get a cup of coffee because I...
Oh, I do that whenever I read about coffee in a book. I immediately go up to the kitchen and make myself a cup.
You know, we talked about how the book is kind of like a book of optimism, but having recently heard, since, you know, you talk about politics, and we talk, and you can't talk about politics without me waking up every morning and thinking Donald J. Trump is president of the United States of America, and you know it's mind-boggling. So anyway, Deb says no radical change comes during good times, which is kind of like the famous Chinese curse: "May you live in interesting times." So do you think that's true? And are we due for radical change because we are living in interesting times?
Yeah, I do. You know, I was finishing up the edits on this book after the 2016 election. So I was aware of where we were going and had a couple months post-Trump being president to insert, I think, lines like that of Deb's. And what I observed and have observed in the last year is that the era of complacency is over. I have become much more politically active, and everyone I know has become much more politically active, whether that's helping refugees or working or running for office or, you know, helping all sorts of grassroots and local and national efforts. So we have all changed, I believe, with this election, and what the outcome will be, I don't know. I really don't know. You know, I live in Bernie Sanders land, and so Vermont is still hanging on to this dream that a true revolution is possible, whether it's him at the helm or ideally someone of color or a woman. The optimist in me thinks that maybe this is just the groundwork for a real revolution.
You know, again, changing subjects like I do, one of the things I wondered at the beginning, not so much at the end, but at the beginning, was why does Vail come home in the first place? Because she's been estranged from her mom, and there's so many things her mom has done to hurt her, and her mom is flawed, deeply flawed. So what draws her back to her mom when she's been absent from her in so many ways for so long a time?
Yeah. I think that... it's one thing to be estranged from somebody who you believe is still in the world, and then the possibility of losing someone for good makes us feel much more generous, I think. So on just a personal level, I think that there is a lot of love in that relationship from Vail's early years, and she wants to find that love again and that warmth and connection that she knew when she was younger before her mother was ill. And then I don't think she has any desire when she first comes back to connect with the landscape or the people, her family members who are living here. But I think that she gets drawn in and starts to see something in Deb, her aunt, see a potential for a sense of family there that she has not had. And even in Hazel to begin to feel kind of a warmth and forgiveness and recognition of our human flaws and that there's still room for love despite those wounds. So my goal with the book is that the landscape draws her in despite her resistance.
Yeah, it's like, you know, what you were saying about Bernie Sanders, and, you know, and you are proud of the fact that you're in area code 802, the Vermont area code. So it's fitting that let me ask you this, and maybe we can end with this, is now that you have these characters and they're so alive to you and so alive to me too, do you have plans for them? do they feature in your future life?
It is so hard to spend years with these people and then let them go. Vail was the protagonist of one of my stories in Half Wild. So I like to think that maybe my works will all be connected in some subtle way, the way that Louise Erdrich weaves characters, familiar characters into her work, Faulkner, of course. And I am starting a new novel, and there is a character from this book in that novel, although it's a side character who just appears in a very small place, and I don't yet want to reveal who it is because this novel is very new, and I just need to keep it secret in order for it to stay alive.
That's the perfect way to end our conversation. I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed the book and talking to you today. And as I said, owning an independent bookstore, it's nice to be able to have books like yours on the front desk and be able to tell people, hey, you got to read this book. It's great. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam. And thank you for doing the amazing work of selling books. That's just one of the best jobs in the world. And I'm immensely grateful.
It's a labor of love. If you come down here, I'll be glad to give you the key to the front door of the bookstore and I can just walk away.
You can go write your novel.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Okay.
Yes.
Thanks again.
All right. Well, maybe I will be able to visit someday.
That would be great.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. We were talking with Robin MacArthur, author of Heartspring Mountain, which is her first novel, just published in January by Echo Press. It's a novel that draws you in slowly, but draws you in inexorably. And I was very moved by it. It was very thought-provoking. And I think it's a good book for a book club. I think it's also very cinematic and would make a great movie. In any event, I really enjoyed talking with her. And she lives in Vermont, and she's understandably proud of where she lives, and her family has lived there for a long time. And, you know, it's definitely a book that is well worth taking a look at, as are the upcoming guests we have, which is, I don't know. We have Chandler Klang Smith, who discusses her debut novel, The Sky Is Yours, which is science fiction, which I love. Really good book. New York Times bestselling author Jojo Moyes, with whom you are very familiar with, I'm sure, will join us again to discuss her latest novel, Still Me, which is the end of the trilogy that most of you have read, starting with Me Before You, or no, You Before Me. And then Exhenet Ayu will share her highly anticipated debut novel, Brass. So join us. I mean, there's tons of stuff to learn, and there's tons of people to talk to, and nothing gives me more pleasure than being able to do so every week and to have you here to join me on The Avid Reader.